Since 1800, in 51 out of 52 cases where a country's debt-to-GDP ratio reached 130%, the country eventually defaulted. The only exception is current Japan, who is frankly in the final stages of circling the drain. For example, central bank asset purchases and yield curve control. Where is the U.S. now? 129% debt-to-GDP. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we are diving into a read today. I am still traveling, so we're a little light on the episodes, but I wanted to kind of bang out an episode, a read by Jesse Myers. This was posted very recently, and it's called The Bondholders' Burning Platform. And it's something, especially with the BRICS nations basically announcing or making it public that they are going moving forward with a gold-backed currency, and they are literally a huge economic block. In fact, an economic block in the world that's arguably the largest, I think. I'll check the math on it before we get into the guy's takes. That they are moving forward with a competing monetary standard and a gold-backed currency. I think the days of light or manageable inflation are over, and we should expect maybe 10 to 20% a year as a common occurrence, as something normal, because there's just so many different variables stacking on top of each other that kind of compound the problem. And, you know, the BRICS currency could still end up being a bit of a nothing burger, but I increasingly don't think so. But we'll get into it a little bit. In fact, I think I'm going to do a guy's take episode specifically about that will lean a lot on what Jesse or Croesus talks about in this piece. And by the way, Croesus is or Jesse Myers, we've done, I think, maybe two pieces on the show before, Bitcoin in the American West. And did Croesus do the one with the yuppie elite? I think that's a really good episode either way. I'll have the link in the show notes, but I'll figure out which ones Jesse Myers' pieces are, but they are really good. I just remember. I'll have those links in the show notes so you can check those out. What's up, Jesse, if you listen to this? And we will go ahead and just jump right in to today's read. Real quick, let's just thank our sponsors and we will dig in. A huge thank you to Fold and the Fold debit card. I am all the way back to a million sats that I've gotten back in my debit card with Amazon and a lot of traveling that we've been doing. Again, using those gift cards and the merchants is such a great way to stack extra. But if you want sats back on everything that you do with a debit card, replace your boring bank debit card that pays you nothing and get sats instead. Go to bitcoinaudible.com/fold and you will get 50,000 sats free. And then after you get all those sats back and the free sats, just for checking it out, you're going to withdraw it to your cold card, because that's the only way that you know you own it. It is on your hard drive, your hardware wallet generated by your keys, and you can get 9% off the cold card. It is a super versatile, super secure wallet, 9% off. At the CoinKite store, go to bitcoinaudible.com/coldcard. All of those links will be clickable and right in front of you if you just read the description of this show. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled The Bondholders' Burning Platform by Jesse Myers. An inflationary inferno is coming this decade. Find out which assets in your portfolio will withstand the heat and which will go up in flames. Before we get going, if you've enjoyed my articles or content on Twitter, @Croesus_BTC, be sure to subscribe to my weekly Bitcoin newsletter, Once in a Species. 1 to 2 posts a week to help you understand why Bitcoin could be the key to growing your wealth this decade. Get on the free email list to receive it. Link will be available in the show notes. And thanks for your support. Okay, now, on with our story. In management consulting, an important framework for catalyzing change in an organization is the burning platform. At all times, there's a great deal of inertia keeping anyone from enacting change. If you've been standing safely on a platform for many years, you're not likely to want to jump off of it. But it's a lot easier to make the leap into the unknown if suddenly the platform is on fire. The first step in change is recognizing that you're on a burning platform. The status quo. When it comes to generally accepted portfolio construction, the larger the allocation to bonds, the quote, safer the portfolio. When you log into Vanguard, Fidelity, or wherever your 401k lives, you'll see portfolio composition options to choose from with descriptors like aggressive, standard, and conservative. Standard means a portfolio comprised 60% of stocks and 40% of bonds. Aggressive means a greater percent of stocks. Conservative means a greater percent of bonds. The message is clear. The more bonds you have, the less risky your portfolio. And it's no wonder that bonds are framed in this favorable light. The quintessential bonds are U.S. Treasury bills, aka Treasuries, USTs, T-bills, which is just a fancy way of saying U.S. national debt coupons. These T-bills are widely known and universally accepted as the, quote, risk-free asset. This categorization is so foundational to finance and wealth management that we never take a step back to question it. So let's do just that. In truth, the overall risk of T-bills consists of three parts. Nominal default risk. Verdict, risk-free. T-bills are guaranteed to deliver on their nominal promises, so long as the U.S. government exists. If a bond promises to pay 5% of the face value of the bond every year in interest, that's what it will do. This is because the U.S. government can always print more money or issue more debt to service its debt obligations in nominal terms. Duration risk. Verdict? Try not to think about it. Every bond has an origination date. Market conditions on that day dictate the terms of the bond, specifically the interest rate that the bond issuer promises to pay in exchange for dollars today. The problem is the interest rates change in the years between the bond's issuance and maturity date. The result is that the market value of a bond fluctuates based on whether interest rates go up or down relative to the bond's interest rate. If market interest rates go down, the bond's promised interest payments are greater than what is available on newly issued debt, so the bond trades at a premium. Vice versa, if interest rates go up. Duration risk means that the market value of the bonds a person holds can go up or down, though the annual interest payments remain the same. As a result, duration risk is often hand-waved away by some variation of there's no risk so long as you hold to maturity. In other words, you get exactly the nominal yield that you signed up for. Just don't think about it too much if interest rates go up and you're locked into a low-yielding bond. Inflation risk. Verdict. Negligible in theory, plenty of risk in reality. This is the hidden risk that nobody talks about with bonds. While T-bills are guaranteed to pay out in nominal terms, there is no guarantee about what those future dollars will be worth in real terms. For instance, if a bond promises to pay 5% annually in interest payments, but inflation is running at 10%, congratulations, you've earned a risk-free nominal return while actually becoming poorer in real terms. The reason that nobody talks about this risk is because a bond's interest rate is assumed to account for inflation over the life of the bond. But this overlooks a crucial scenario. Smoke and heat. The U.S. has a debt problem. It also has a spending problem. This is a bad combination. Over the last few decades, we have normalized massive annual deficits. These numbers add to our national debt, which shows the cumulative effect of these relentless deficits. I strongly encourage you to check out these two charts. We've got the U.S. annual surplus or deficit through end of year 2022, and just showing the staggering increase in the deficits down in 2020, all the way to negative $3 trillion, and now just shy of negative $1.5 trillion. And then the cumulative U.S. national debt as of end of year 2022 as well, and the almost comically absurd spike, negative spike downward, that is literally so sharp it almost looks like there's no time between negative $24 trillion in debt and $32 trillion in debt. But if you want to get an idea of the trend, I highly suggest looking at these. Clever skeptics are quick to point out that the above charts are fine so long as GDP growth has kept pace. Well, it hasn't. And this is the key point. Because a high debt-to-GDP ratio is the harbinger of trouble. Since 1800, in 51 out of 52 cases where a country's debt-to-GDP ratio reached 130%, the country eventually defaulted. The only exception is current Japan, who is frankly in the final stages of circling the drain, e.g. central bank asset purchases and yield curve control. Where is the U.S. now? 129% debt to GDP. What's more, U.S. government officials fully expect this trend to continue. In fact, more alarming than that, they don't seem to even realize that this is a five-alarm crisis. Here is an actual projection published by the U.S. Treasury Department. Also here, check the link so you can see this chart. This chart looks absurd, right? Surely things aren't that bad. Well, remember how politicians recently fought about raising the debt ceiling beyond $31.4 trillion before eventually rubber stamping it? The U.S. has already added $1 trillion to the U.S. national debt in the month since. Remember all the fighting and drama around the 2008 bank bailouts and Occupy Wall Street? That was all because of $1 trillion. We just added that in a month, and nobody made a peep. Flames are next. The only way out of the fiscal situation the U.S. has gotten itself into is to inflate away the debt. This means letting inflation run hot for years, long enough to more than 2x the price of everything, which makes the national debt 2x easier to pay off, since this debt is owed in nominal terms. There really is no other way out. It's just math. For a full rundown, see this in-depth piece on the U.S. national debt. This inflation is an inferno that will rip through the entire global asset landscape, consuming anything in its path that it can. Visualization of the global asset breakdown. Bitcoin at the very beginning with a very small $600 billion next to gold at $12 trillion, art at $18 trillion, cars and collectibles at $6 trillion, global equities at $115 trillion, global real estate at $330 trillion, global debt at $300 trillion, and global broad money at $120 trillion. Total global asset value, $900 trillion. All of these asset categories shown here are their own elevated platform, each providing stability and safekeeping for investors that choose to park value there. But they are not all made of the same stuff. Some are made of wood, others are made of various composites, and a few are made of steel. Here's my assessment of each category's suitability to withstand the stress of an inflationary inferno. Wood. These assets are fiat currency, money, and debt contracts for future fiat currency payment streams, bonds. These assets will not withstand high inflation. Marked on the visual, these are global broad money at $120 trillion and global debt at $300 trillion. Composites. These assets carry varying properties and varying degrees of susceptibility to fire. For example, equities provide some inflation resistance because future cash flows will continue inflation adjusted, but many may not survive the strain of economic turmoil to get to that future state. example from the visualization of assets. This includes global real estate at $330 trillion, global equities at $115 trillion, cars and collectibles at $6 trillion, and art at $18 trillion. And then there is steel. These assets are forged in scarcity and do not come with cash flows based in fiat currency terms, as equities and real estate do. These assets will withstand high inflation, retaining and likely growing their purchasing power. For example, gold grew 20x in value during the 1970s. From the visual, the quote-unquote steel assets are gold and Bitcoin. Taking action. Right now, there's just smoke, heat, and a little bit of flame developing. You have time to take stock of which platforms you have stored your value on, evaluate whether any changes make sense, and take any necessary action. The first step in this process is to figure out how much of your net worth you have in each of the asset categories above. When was the last time you logged into your brokerage to see the composition of your 401k? What percent of your net worth is currently held in bonds? My expectation is that the number will surprise you. The classic portfolio composition is 60-40-0, meaning 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and 0% hard assets, gold or Bitcoin. This portfolio made sense over the last 40 years of declining interest rates and debt-fueled financial asset valuation growth. But those conditions won't continue. Mathematically, can't continue. Instead, the forecast is for fire. Plan accordingly. And another thing to point out, especially in the stage that we are in, is that if you get your Bitcoin, if you buy Bitcoin now, you still have the opportunity to quickly and cheaply withdraw it to your keys, to your hardware wallet, and you can get 9% off with the cold card. But please, don't be the person who actually did get into Bitcoin ahead of time, but then didn't hold their own keys. They got trapped on an exchange or locked into BlackRock's ETF or some garbage financial product that isn't actually Bitcoin. Use a secure, trusted hardware wallet like the Cold Card. And don't forget that the Cold Card is actually incredibly accessible. You can use it with your mobile. You can use it with the NFC. I know I talk about that all the time, but using it with NFC with Nunchuck and like roping it into multi-sig is such a great kind of on-the-go setup. I have my cold card at home. I have my tap signer, which you can also get from CoinKite. And then I have the key that is on the phone with the two of three multi-sig. And all I ever do to send a payment, to make a transaction, is I tap my tap signer to it. And if I ever have any sort of a problem, I can always recover it with the cold card that I have back at home. But you can literally make it even simpler. There's just having a cold card and having your own keys and having it separate from the internet is 100x the security that the average person has. And you can just tap the cold card right to the phone and sign a transaction whenever you need it. Again, 9% off with code Bitcoin Audible. The link will be right there for you in the show notes. So check it out. All right. A huge thank you to Croesus for this piece, or Jesse for this piece, because short and to the point, and I think provides a very strong visualization or analogy as to how you should just think about this going forward and understand that, like, this time is not different. There is no this time is different. The only thing that has kept America, kept the US dollar specifically, from basically being in a situation where it would be in a downward spiral already, was just because of the amount of inflation we have been able to export as the global reserve currency. It just means that someone else is paying for our shit. And I really like the visual, the analogy of the different types of assets, the wood assets, which are bonds and fiat currencies and fiat debts, which are going to be worth fuck all. They're just going to be absolute garbage for the next couple of decades, probably. And the bond bubble, the peak of bonds as like a safe asset, are so gone, it's ridiculous. Because even the Even the tempered and completely manipulated down inflation rates outpace bonds by a good margin, which means that if you want to park money in bonds, you're just parking it in a place to bleed. It's like putting it in a gas tank that has a small hole instead of a big hole. It's really not a whole lot different. It's just not a good place to put gas. Like if I wanted to keep gas somewhere, I would want it to keep it in a container that just doesn't leak. That would seem like the sensible place to keep it, especially when there's a lot of heat and a lot of smoke around. Gasoline is just not the place you want to put your value anyway. That is fiat. That is bonds. That is government debt. That is where all of that is going to go, because the deficits aren't just a U.S. phenomenon. In fact, the U.S. is kind of been a leading global example of the policies and behaviors of pretty much all Western nations. They've largely been the standard. And because of that, they've also been kind of a regulatory standard. Is when the U.S. has set some sort of regulatory precedent, it usually kind of cascades around the world, is they kind of use that as the example. And there's actually some potential good in the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty in that realm and a lot of breakdown in the social, both the social and political power of the United States, that there is going to be a lot more of policy and regulatory competition. And I think we've already seen it. If you take an honest look at the last 3 to 4 years, I think that's what you would see. If you look around the world, you have a whole bunch of countries that are just kind of ignoring countries that you would have thought always were going to kind of bow to what the U.S. wanted done or what they posture for. And there were these kind of like subtle threats, not so subtle threats of do what we say, or there's going to be problems for you. We're going to tax, you know, new tariffs. There were always the various methods that the U.S. had to exert control. And just the fact that other people were listening, other countries would follow suit with the United States, was enough often to just kind of strong arm countries to do what was helpful for American policy and for American policy to kind of be a global standard. But I think we've watched that fall apart in the last 3 or 4 years. Almost completely. We see a lot of smaller, or at least in the sense of this seeming obvious dominance, that if the U.S. says something or makes some sort of regulatory push, that this is what Europe is going to do, this is what, you know, South America, that a lot of countries are just kind of fall in line and play by these same rules. And what's funny, and this is something that we've talked about on the show numerous times, we talked about before 2020 and all of this kind of unfolded, is that likely what was going to happen is, as trust broke down, is you would see one or two countries get away with just doing something blatantly at odds, like boldly denying or dismissing what the United States policy, or the United States regime, sought to have. And then it would just break down everywhere else. And when they had one to two cracks to seal up and try to keep from, you know, turning into a flood, there were going to be 1,000 cracks everywhere else. It was just going to, it's like social permission, right? This is a normal human phenomenon, is that when one person stands up to the bully or stands up to the one that's supposedly in charge, well, then it kind of gives permission for the next 20 to just kind of like, well, that worked out for them. Now there's this unspoken permission to, let's just not, this is just not the social order anymore. And it tends to break down really fast. If you ever see the key example or the prime example of social permission is when there's a whole bunch of people waiting for a light to change, or, you know, waiting across the street and there's like no cars coming and nobody's doing anything. And then one person just starts walking. The whole flood of people just kind of come behind and is like, oh, well, they're going, so now I can do it. I think we kind of have an interesting situation in the political sphere, in the kind of geopolitical environment, is that, and you could maybe say that Russia is a decent example of the utter failure of the U.S. trying to exert its power, because it doesn't have the economic power anymore, but it's still trying to exert control by using the reins of the global financial infrastructure. It's just trying to squeeze everybody by using the dollar as a political weapon. But the thing is that the use of the dollar is the only reason that the U.S. deficits and the massive U.S. debt can be offloaded to the rest of the world. So they're using what has already been trapping other countries into a burden, like what they see as they're having to pay the cost of the U.S. deficit, and something that they would prefer not to do, but at least they got the benefit of the dollar. At least they got the benefit of the global network. But now it's being used as a weapon against any country. And this was just totally admitted. This was admitted just the other day. There was a clip, and I'll probably have it for, I'll try to get it together for the Guys Take episode, because I really want to dig into the BRICS stuff and their quote unquote gold-backed currency, whether or not it, I really want to dig into the feasibility of this, how serious they are about it. Is this going to be like a nothing burger where they're like, oh, we're doing this, and they make a big show of it and they don't really use it? I'd say there's enough cases of, you know, the attempts of starting some sort of political move or a political platform that kind of fizzled out, that this could be that. But I increasingly think, because of the environment, it's incredibly foolish to totally dismiss it as that without a serious look. And so that's what I want to do. Hopefully I'll be able to get that together in the next couple of days. But Yellen specifically said that, yes, we are using, I can't remember exactly the quote, but it was something about like using the dollar as a weapon, like we're using it for political control or to exert political force or something like that. And which was just so comically blatant, is this like, well, why would anybody want to, like, if Walmart used the fact that you were coming into the store to get something as a way to literally trap you there and then force you to buy something else, or force you to pay interest on Walmart's debt or something, what would you consider that a good, like maybe you were used to shopping at Walmart? You know, Creasa says it, or Jesse says it in this article, is that there's a lot of inertia in just doing things the way that you're used to doing them. But when something is literally on fire, when something's being thrown in your face, when something's being used as a weapon against you, well, that's a whole lot of motivation that literally the U.S. is creating in order to get people to figure out how to stop doing business with the U.S. And they're doing this when they are no longer the dominant trading partner with practically anyone anymore. There's a chart of over the last 20 years how China has become the dominant trading partner with practically the whole world. When you're sitting on ever increasing debt and deficits and spending habits that fight over how much more we are going to spend rather than what degree of surplus we're going to, if we don't start having trillion-dollar surpluses, we're screwed. And when you have that environment and that level of behavior, that complete lack of restraint or responsibility in your politicians, and at the exact same time, your economic dominance is just kind of, has nothing but kind of social inertia. There's no strong underpinning. You exported all of your manufacturing to East Asia, and then an unbelievable portion of economic activity in the country is just pointless managerial and administrative tasks. We have like 3 or 4 times as many administrators to workers as we did, which is so stupid. It's complete waste. There's a really, really great book that I read pretty recently called Bullshit Jobs, talking about there's so much administration and just purely managerial work for the sake of manager, like managers for managers, that you could literally take, and this was actually judged by the people themselves, the people who were in the best position to judge whether or not their job is actually worthwhile. And they have every incentive to come up with a reason to believe for themselves that their job is in fact meaningful and that it's very necessary to the process of the enterprise. And I think this is totally a consequence of the debt fueled bubble. Like this is asset valuations exploding and debt financing being available at orders of magnitude past what is actually functionally useful, in the sense that, like, if you have a strong plan that you can add, you know, this many machines to make this many new shirts or something like that, and you know there's a good market for this many shirts, and you need like $1 million, but then debt financing just makes it so that you get $30 million or $50 million and you can afford this, well, then you just literally have to figure out how to spend the other 49. And part of that is actually circular valuation growth, is that then you get $50 million and then you can, all, well, what do you do? What do you do with that other 49? You just buy up competitors. You just figure out how to eat more of the market. And so you just get big because you're big. And then your valuation is more likely to keep up with inflation because you're actually the funnel. Your company actually becomes the funnel by which the new debt is being issued, the new money, the currency is being issued into the economy. So even though you really only had a viable $1 million project, the fact that we pushed $49 million more in debt doesn't mean that you have another $49 million in viable, long-term, sustainable project. It means you have $49 million to blow. And that is basically the situation. That's a decent allegory for the situation that our financial markets have been in for the last 30 to 40 years, is this endless toxic bigness where the big companies, you just keep giving them more debt because they're likely to keep up with inflation, and then their stock valuations are going to be, P&E ratios don't mean shit anymore. The stock valuations just go up because we've inflated the currency, and by inflating the currency, we've dumped, or we have specifically inflated the currency by dumping debt into things that are already big, because it's thoughtless, it's easy. And that's why small, solid, like reasonable investments, real investments in small towns and in small communities, and debt that actually makes functional and practical sense over the short to medium term, have disappeared, because it's too easy to just invest in something that's going to have a nominal gain, because that's where you're putting the new debt. If you issue new currency and you give it to organization A, they're going to bid up all the prices and their stock value is going to go up before everything else because you issued them money, which means that big things for the sake of being big are the things that are going to outpace inflation, because that's where the inflation of the actual currency is going to funnel through. So it's just this completely circular, it's this self-fulfilling prophecy that destroys everything that's small and meaningful and just dumps an ungodly amount of money into the counterfeit and managerial class. And so what do? After 30 years, you look at the healthcare system, and healthcare prices are skyrocketing. The customer is kind of like a distant thought, and it's not even a situation or an organization and environment that's designed for patients to be comfortable or patient-centric at all. And it's just a shit ton of managers and administrators and mountains of bureaucracy. And what you do is you look at the chart for growth in healthcare, major components of the healthcare. You see the number of beds that we have for patients is actually static, or I think even down from like the 1970s, despite huge growth in the population. That the number of doctors has seen very, very small growth, but it has actually grown. But the number of administrators has grown like 400%, which just means that it takes more people to do the same stuff. It's literally as if we took a forklift and then we turned it into 10 people with shovels. We just did it in the administrative state. And it's because there is so much money to blow in giant organizations in which newly issued currency as debt gets pushed through, that they have to figure out how to build a bigger position, buy up their competitors. And this is why the VC markets have turned into, rather than actually building something viable over the long run, it's slowly degraded more and more in shorter and shorter time to turn around, where VCs aren't even looking for good startups that are even viable anymore. They're looking for startups that can get just enough runway to sell to somebody big, to sell to Google, to sell to some giant bloated organization that just has a whole bunch of a fuck ton more debt, because that's where it's being issued. Just give it to the big company and they'll buy more shares. All of this corporate hugeness is not natural. It is a consequence of the fiat apparatus and the inflation that I think we're going to see. And we'll talk about this in the guy's take. But the reason I think we're going to see, I mean, what Jesse says is we're going to see inflation run hot for a long time. I think it will be very normal to see 10 to 20% inflation. And it'll probably get, publicly declared 5% inflation, but your house will be 25% worth 25% more. And that's where, a lot of it will go, real estate, stocks, and the like. But the reason, going back to the analogy that Jesse made of, you know, fiat and bonds, debt, fiat debt, national debt, national currency, that these things are made of wood and the forecast is fire. And then there's the composites. There's real estate, there's equity, there's collectibles, these sorts of things. Now, the reason I think that's a really interesting way to put it is because a lot of these things are also based on the value of the underlying economy and the health of the underlying economy. And inflation is a machine of economic destruction. It destroys all of the fundamental incentives, and the only reason the economy keeps working at all is because people desperately need to work to survive. They just have to make things keep going. The machine has to keep turning. But think about how insidious inflation is at 10 to 20%. That anybody who consumes, and I use my own example, is like if I do the basic math on like buying solar panels or something to get my, let's say I wanted to get my house off the grid. If I do the basic math on it, it makes no sense. It is not economical at all. It's a huge, huge upfront expense to save a small monthly expense, which I'll basically end up even with like 0% down and, you know, 1% interest or something retarded like that. I'll still end up paying a comparable amount, to a utility. Even with that, by the time I pay it off, the debt, imagine I've got 10% inflation every year. I will never, ever, ever, ever pay back the value of those solar panels. But if I have 10% inflation a year, that makes brilliant sense to go into debt for like a 15, 30 year term to put a bunch of useless solar panels. We'll put solar panels on my home that are going to benefit me, but will never pay back the lender the value that they actually loaned. And those loans will correspond in the value of retirements. There's no, this isn't like disconnected from society. It's not as if this isn't costing somebody something, but there's nothing else to do. That is literally what you are incentivized to do, to go into as much debt as you can, because it's going to get eviscerated by the inflation rate. If you have 10 to 20% inflation and you buy a house now at, you know, $200,000, well then, you know, in 4 to 5 years, it'll take you a few months worth of a decent salary to actually pay it off. At an inflation rate that high, which means that the builder, the amount of resources, we'll use a very explicit example so you can understand the degree of destruction that this is causing in the economy. Because I think debt and money and inflation rates all just kind of conflate what's actually happening. So let's say it takes 2,000 boards. You have to harvest 2,000 boards and, you know, 10,000 nails or 100,000 nails or some crap in order to build a house. Let's make it explicit. Let's do 1,000 boards and 10,000 nails. That's simple. And so you go into debt and you're supposed to pay, you know, a little bit of interest on it. So you're supposed to pay back, because it's going to take you 10 years to pay it back, 15 years or something like that. You're supposed to pay back 12,000 nails and 1,200 boards. You're supposed to work that much. And your job is literally to make boards and nails. So over those 10 to 15 years, you're supposed to you took out 1,000 boards and you took out 1,000 nails, and you're supposed to put it back, because that's the only way the economy works, is if you put back in what you take out. If everybody does that, then society survives. Society thrives, actually, because then it means that everybody can do their individual job and nobody's getting screwed. Everybody's just actually trading with each other, value for value. There is a net positive in every single exchange. If you have inflation destroying the nominal value of these things at 10 to 20% a year, it literally means that in 10 years you can pay off the full debt with like 100 boards and maybe 50 nails. So you consumed 1,000 boards and 10,000 nails, and you put maybe a tenth of that back. The loss is 90% of the capital and resources needed to build the house, because you just waited, because you just took the debt and waited to get it, to watch it get eviscerated by the government. And this happens at every single level. This happens at credit card debt. This happens at, you know, buying a car. This happens at buying a house. This happens with anything that you purchase on debt that you have long-term positioned in nominal dollar terms. The producers get screwed and the consumers get massively rewarded. And so we just eat everything and we put nothing back. We harvest every single bit of the corn, of the wheat, of all the cattle, everything, and we have nothing to breed for next season. We have no seeds to plant for next harvest, because then we chopped up the seeds and we put it in Chex Mix and, you know, a bunch of, we just ate the seed. We ate everything, and then we have nothing next year. And this happens again and again, and the cycle gets worse and worse and worse, and the GDP still goes up, inflation still goes up, still looks like everything's fine, but society is literally eating itself from the inside out. This is the capital strip mine. I highly encourage listening to and or reading Bitcoin is Venice, the book, which should be on Audible pretty soon. We're still just waiting for confirmation from Audible, and or the capital strip mine. This is, I think it's chapter three, maybe, in the book. Such a good book, Bitcoin is Venice. Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers. So good. It's still one of my favorites. But you can listen to that chapter specifically, the original article that it's based off of, called The Capital Strip Mine by Alan Farrington. And that is on this show. I have no idea. It's probably 300 reads ago. I don't know. I'll dig it out and put it in the show notes for you. But because of that, the consequence of that is that stocks, a lot of these composite goods, might not hold up because they're incredibly dependent, and a lot of these companies won't make it through. So you can't just, like, especially in the age of toxic bigness, you won't be able to just put money in some quote unquote reliable stock and have the stock go up, or, you know, in a stock index and have everything just kind of go up in price. They are generally a lot more resilient than fiat debt. I mean, fiat debt, who the hell wants to hold a bond that's paying 6% when you're eating and you're getting 10%, 20% losses every year in inflation? Nobody. And who the hell wants to buy your 1% to 2% inflation or 1% to 2% interest bonds when the interest rates are 6%, 7%? Maybe they get up to 10%. Who knows? Your 1%, 2% bond? In a 10%, 20% inflation and where interest rates generally are 6 to 10%, your 1% bond is worth nothing. Jack all. I hope that you didn't have a 40% allocation in your 401k, because that shit is gone. But especially going to those market goods made of steel, the Bitcoin and the gold. Those especially will be really interesting. Gold is actually going to be really interesting. And I still think probably more towards the midterm, Bitcoin is going to eat a lot of gold's market share. And what's funny is the very same thing that's going to be a huge push for gold, I suspect will be a big push for Bitcoin, is this BRICS nations, the BRICS announcement of a gold-backed currency and a joint currency in a competing monetary, global monetary regime with huge economic powers. I think that is going to be a huge boon for gold. But what's interesting is the lack of monetary consensus, the fact that the global dollar is splintering and cracking and will probably be in steep decline for the foreseeable future. But the fact that dollar consensus is breaking down and there is a massive economic contingent with a competing currency and a potentially gold-backed currency doesn't just mean that, like, oh, now everybody's going to use this currency. I don't think that's what it means. It certainly won't mean that their infrastructure or their global liquidity will be any huge immediate accessibility. Like, it will probably take decades to really build out the infrastructure to make it a huge global contingent. Or at least I suspect maybe it's, you know, a much shorter timeline. We are in a very different environment technologically. But regardless, it won't be overnight. And it won't be obvious that, like, if I'm dropping the dollar, I'm trying to protect myself from the dollar, that, like, well, of course, I'm just going to go to the BRICS nations. Like, this is going to be political turmoil and distrust and chaos for a good span of time. And the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that it is the ultimate neutrality, right? It's truly global. BRICS will not be global because the West will not allow it in. The Western nations, particularly the U.S., is going to fight it with everything that they can with their infrastructure and their global, the access and the control that they have over the global financial rails. And then simultaneously, like vice versa, the Russia and China, if they are literally trying to make a push against the dollar, they are going to try to make it harder for the dollar. So what's going to happen, and again, we talked about this so much on the show, it's just interesting the flavors of what is the flavors of the moves that are happening and exactly what it looks like, because that's the one thing we didn't know, right, as these things are unfolding. But all the walls are going up. And what's the great thing about Bitcoin is it squeezes through all the walls. You know, as everybody puts up their firewall, everybody puts up their capital control, Bitcoin's the one thing that will maintain consensus throughout, that can squeeze through the cracks in every single one of their firewalls and will still be a global accessible network, whether it's illegal or whatever. And the numerous examples we have of Bitcoin being made illegal and doesn't really change anything. Activity in the country continues on like nothing happens. You just don't have these giant political institutions and bureaucratic institutions that dominate the space. Instead, you actually have grassroots, like peer-to-peer adoption. You have these huge things like Paxful, and now they're, in fact, I want to get Ray Youssef on the show pretty soon, hopefully. I've been chatting with him, but I've been doing a very good job, very terrible job of keeping up with our conversation and getting back to him. But I want to have him on the show to talk about the stuff that they're building to basically fix the centralization problem of Paxful. But there's huge peer-to-peer markets in, you know, places like Nigeria where it was essentially outlawed. And multiple places throughout Africa and in South America, Argentina, these things where the grassroots, the user adoption is growing. But the political sphere itself is either just kind of like keep the banks hands off, or is actively against it, is actively attacking it. And since, I think a lot have kind of walked back, Nigeria being a prime example of them kind of loosening their stance a lot to just be like, oh, we weren't really like super against it, even though we like totally outlawed it. But I think it's because of the embarrassment of having such a failure, where they ended up being one of the highest adoption rates per capita in the entire world after, in the years after it was made illegal. Like, that's really embarrassing if you say, no, we definitely cracked down and like nobody was allowed to use it, and then you just had an utter failure. So what do? You just like, oh, no, it was good. We weren't really all that worried about it. But I think the big thing, going along with Jesse's analogy here, is I think the fire breaks aren't going to be put up in a lot of cases. I think the major institutions are not going to properly prepare for the fact that they need to expect a wall of fire to come plowing through their institution. Some will, many, many won't. Political institutions will not. The prime, the peak of the counterfeit class, the ones who purely and completely survive only through counterfeit and the production of basically nothing, will not do it. They won't. I don't think they will see it coming, largely. Or they won't be able to protect themselves because they don't actually know how to make anything anyway. It is literally because of the counterfeit class's existence that they are in the position and have the power and the wealth that they have. But I think this is one of those situations where you just need to start from the bottom up. Like, if the major institutions, if your political institutions, if your the larger institutions of the society are fueling this thing and pouring gasoline on the fire and not making the corrections and not protecting the people and everyone dependent on them, not protecting them from this fire, not putting in fire breaks and not protecting their funds and their lifelong, their retirements and their lifelong capital. Well, then you have to do it at an individual level. You know, if the institution that's responsible for 1 million people's retirements isn't going to put up a fire break, well, then you need 1 million individual people to put up their own fire break. And so it has to be from the ground up. It has to be from the bottom up. The counterfeit class isn't going to save us. They're going to do everything they can to save their own asses, and it will be at our expense again. It always has been. Everybody's going to look out for themselves, and the ones who can print to get out of their situation won't give a flying fuck that it destroys the rest of society, and it means we eat all our seed and we have nothing to plant next season. They haven't cared so far. Why would they start suddenly caring? Hell, most of them do it and they don't even know. I mean, the average person who is benefiting from that, like there's no reason that I would know that that is the consequence of me buying a house now on a 30-year debt or 30-year loan and knowing that I'd never have to pay it off, or that I could sell the house in a few years, pay off the entire loan and still have a whole bunch of extra equity. Like the fact that it ends up meaning net resources are not created, net resources are lost in that exchange. There's no logical reason why I would know that. It's just a good deal, right? It's just the incentive laid out by the fiat structure and by the nature of our money. We have shit money, so it means everybody is encouraged to make shit decisions. So don't go down with the ship. Buy some Bitcoin, put it on your cold card, and if you use fiat, use a fold card, get paid sats. All right, we'll close this one out here. Thank you guys for listening. This is a really great article. I really enjoyed this one. The Once in a Species Substack of Jesse Myers. Definitely check this one out. I subscribed. I threw my email address at him. And also, don't forget to check out AI Unchained, the next video I want to release, which I do not think will do well on the podcast. I'm considering releasing it, but it seems silly, I think, I want to do a video of unlimited free transcription for audio and video, and for like podcasts or anything like that. Because, you know, a lot of people pay a lot of money for a service that does this. And I've got a really great workflow that works. And I also want to show how to, because it's a terminal app, but there's actually a really great way to use AI to make it so that you can make it a one-click thing, so that you're not actually having to type in terminal commands. And then you can use AI to make an icon and all of these things. So this is kind of my workflow, and a whole bunch of people have asked me about it, and they've been kind of interested, like, oh wait, how do you do this and this? And so I think there's a lot in just kind of explaining people how I use a lot of the AI tools that I use, because you can actually be incredibly productive and you can automate these things. You know, it's obvious that, oh, I'll use an AI tool to do transcription, but it's not obvious to use a different AI tool, or necessarily obvious to use a different AI tool to automate the process of using the other AI tool, so that you don't have to know how to use it. You know what I mean? Like, you can set it up once and then it will just kind of work for you. So I'm digging into that, but again, it's going to be very, very video centric. So don't forget to check out the YouTube channel and subscribe. It's just The Guy Swan if you want to search it. You'll see, or you could search AI Unchained and you'll just find the episodes, check them out up there. But obviously it's also on the RSS feed. Just those sorts of episodes probably won't show up there, because explaining a bunch of commands and what to do in a terminal window just doesn't seem to like really fit with audio content very well. So with that, don't forget to subscribe to Bitcoin Audible. Check out Jesse Myers Substack and all the links I have available in the show notes, the other reads and excellent pieces that I mentioned. And of course, check out the YouTube channel and AI Unchained. And I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back. all that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. J.R.R. Tolkien.